Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Institute of Art and Ideas, articles, videos, and podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, the podcast that brings you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. On today's episode, we're discussing meritocracy and social models of success. Is sorting people by merit dangerous? And should we be championing an alternative model, one more attentive to the role of humility, solidarity, and luck? This week, we're joined by renowned philosopher Michael Sandel, who exposes the hubris a meritocracy generates among the winners and the harsh judgment it imposes on those left behind.
Those who've landed on top have come to believe that their success is their own doing, the measure of their merit.
If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, and head over to our website, iai.tv. Back now to our host for this week, Jesse Norman.
It's my absolute delight and pleasure to have the chance to talk with Michael Sandel about his new book, The Tyranny of Merit. So, Michael, let's just start, if I may, with just the title, The Tyranny of Merit. Can you give us a sense of the overall thrust of the book?
Yes, merit on the face of it seems a good thing. Who could be against giving people jobs or assigning social roles on the basis of merit? And yet, in our time, so it seems to me, Jesse, merit has become a tyranny, especially when the way we define merit is largely based on the money people make, as if that were a true measure of their contribution to the common good. The basic idea of the book is this: for decades, the divide between winners and losers has been deepening. It's been poisoning our politics, driving us apart. The problem is partly the deepening inequality of income and wealth that has come about as a result of globalization. But it's not only that. It has also to do with the changing attitudes toward success and failure that have come with it. Those who've landed on top have come to believe that their success is their own doing, the measure of their merit. And by implication, that those who've been left behind have no one to blame but themselves. This is the harsh side of the meritocratic promise. And the book is about really how we've landed in this deeply polarized political condition, and how the way we've understood merit and meritocracy has reinforced the divide, and then finally, how we might begin to climb out of it.
So at the beginning, then, you were talking about the oppressive effect that what you might call not just the focus on merit, but the idea of a meritocracy in principle might have on those, in a way, a corrupting effect at the top end. People come to believe their own PR, and at the bottom end, because somehow people are being instructed by some elite to believe that they deserve the place that they've been allocated in some way, if I've understood that. Tell me about is that what you really think of as meritocratic hubris? It's a wonderful way of describing this problem.
Yes, by meritocratic hubris, I mean the tendency of the successful to inhale too deeply of their success, to forget the luck and good fortune that helped them on their way, and to assume that since they consider that they have risen thanks to their efforts and talents. The tendency to look down on those who haven't, to assume that they must simply lack the effort and hard work and talent to flourish in the new economy. And a big part of this, perhaps we'll get to it, Jesse, is the idea that the way to compete and win in the global economy is to get a four-year university degree. The idea being that the answer to the inequalities that have deepened is simply or primarily individual upward mobility through a university degree. This induces a kind of credentialism among the winners who come to overvalorize the possession of a university degree. And it leads to a kind of demoralization, even humiliation, among those who don't have a university degree, who, after all, are the majority of our fellow citizens. Nearly two-thirds, we easily forget this, nearly two-thirds of our fellow citizens in the UK and in the US do not have a four-year university degree. So it's folly to have created an economy that sets as a condition of dignified work and a decent life a four-year university degree.
One of the things that's so catching about the book, and arresting indeed about it, is the moment at the beginning where you talk about your own experience with your students at Harvard. And I suppose two things. One is how they all, without fail, attribute their success in having made it to Harvard to the unaided brilliance and laborious hard work that they've put in. And also their utter unawareness that actually, in many ways, American social mobility is thoroughly second rate by international standards.
Because I'll come to the students in a moment. But for many years in America, we've consoled ourselves with the greater degree of inequality in our society than in many European societies, for example, saying, here, we don't need to worry much about inequality because we have a mobile society. No one is consigned to the class of his or her birth, unlike those class-ridden societies of Europe, which do worry so much about inequality. We are an upwardly mobile society, so we don't need to worry about it. And this may actually account for the rather less generous welfare state that the US has by comparison with the UK and European social democracies. But this consoling thought no longer, if it ever did, fits the facts on the ground. One's chances of rising one generation to the next are actually less in the United States than they are in a great many European countries and in Canada. The chance of rising from the bottom fifth of the income scale to the top is about, depending on the study, 4 to 8%. Even the chance of rising to middle class is less than 50%. So we need another way of contending with the deepening inequalities of recent decades than simply to say, if you go off and get a university degree, then maybe you too will be able to rise. Now, I've not addressed your question, Jesse, about my students. I don't want to seem overly harsh to them. I have no, because in many ways they are deeply engaged in activities of public service and good works for their community and for the less fortunate. So I don't mean for the moment to suggest that they are selfish and unconcerned with the public good. What I do notice about them, which is telling with regard to the question of meritocracy, is given what it takes to compete for entry into these highly selective U.S. colleges and universities, student young people's entire adolescent years, sometimes earlier, are converted into a stress-strewn gauntlet of meritocratic striving. Packaging oneself, competing for grades, engaging in extracurriculars, doing good works in distant lands, all the better to impress an admissions committee. It's almost impossible, and this much of this superintended by often rather pushy parents who may hire, if they can, private college consultants who are experts at packaging these young people. But there is such a strenuous insistence on effort and striving and hard work that it's almost impossible not to emerge from this believing that winning admission is down to one's own effort and one's own doing. And so I'm not so much criticizing my students as sympathizing with the wounds that afflict even the winners, because by the time they arrive, many of them, accomplished and gifted, are so driven to achieve, so accustomed to pleasing through achievement, their parents, their teachers, the imagined admissions committees, that they find it difficult to step back and explore and reflect on what's worth caring about and what they really would love to study. So my worry is that the credentialism is crowding out the love of learning.
Yes, I mean, the idea of the free play of the mind that was supposed to be the conception of a liberal arts degree at a university or of, as it were, a rounded human being, but rounded by aspiration and interest rather than by one's curriculum vitae or bio is a distant one in this context. And I thought that was a point well made. And also, I think the point about the way in which the top universities have simultaneously become so competitive as a result of this obsessive interest that actually the likelihood of people succeeding has massively fallen. And therefore you end up with a kind of epidemic of mental illness on the one hand, and yet at the same time, a rather strange mindset, which is, which you do detect actually amongst some of these people, which is, you know, what should I say? Kiss up, kick down. If I think this person's got something to teach me or some way of enhancing my credentials, I'll be quite dutiful in regard to them. But if I think they're my cognitive inferior, I will give them a good kicking. And there's a bit of that if I detect it myself. Let me ask you a question though, Michael, which is, I mean, I take it we're not moving away, and you're not calling for us to move away from merit as a criterion for selection of jobs or public offices or any of the like. So how does that relate to your concern about this obsessive pursuit of merit and the credentials of merit in society? Because you might think there's a tension between those two things.
Yes, that's right, Jesse. I'm not saying that we shouldn't hire people for jobs based on merit. If I or a loved one goes in for surgery, I want a very well-qualified surgeon to perform it. So that's not the issue. The issue is, well, I think there are two aspects of meritocracy that give rise to the dark side, to the harsh ethic of success that polarizes our societies and that contributes to the unraveling of the social bonds that hold us together. One of them is the idea that money, the money people make, is the measure, the true measure of their contribution to the common good. The other is casting a university degree as a necessary condition, not only for success in the economy, but also for social recognition and prestige and honor. I think these are two of the unfortunate dimensions of the version of market-driven meritocracy that we have arrived at over the past four decades. And I think we need to ask ourselves the question, including in politics, how to begin to find our way to a more generous politics of the common good. And one way of doing that, it seems to me, is to focus less on equipping the people for meritocratic combat and to focus more on the dignity of work, on asking, how can we reconfigure the economy so that we more broadly reward but also respect the contributions that people make through the work they do, the families they raise, the communities they serve, whether or not they are highly credentialed. These are the ways I think we need to begin to rethink what counts as merit and who deserves what and why.
I mean, because there's a difficult problem in a way, isn't there, Michael, which is that if you're right, and I think there's an enormous amount of truth in what you're saying, then the idea that any policy as such could remedy the issue, it seems to be quite a stretched one. You might imagine a process of evolution with a series of different policy measures designed to enfranchise and recognize and to change status differentials and potentially to row back a little bit on some of the more egregious reward systems that reinforce this position. But it's hard to imagine any specific policy picking this up. But you do have one really interesting idea, which I'd just like to touch on if we can, which I think is fascinating, which is the idea that we might move towards, or at least you scout the possibility of moving towards a lottery type admission system for some of the top universities. Now, of course, I love that. I think that's a genius idea. I've called for it in other contexts and myself. And one of the reasons why is because it forces the university to focus on actually adding to the educational accomplishments of the person when they arrive, because they don't get to cheat by just choosing, as it were, the cream of the cream through the meritocratic crop.
Well, yes. So my proposal in this will, I'm sure, get me in a good bit of trouble in my neighborhood. Is to take for universities that have far more well-qualified applicants than they have places for, to run what I call a lottery of the qualified. So, for example, Harvard and Stanford, to take examples I know here in the U.S., receive over 40,000 applicants for each, for about 2,000 places. The admissions officers tell us that most of the students who apply could do the work and do it well and contribute to their classroom discussion and the education of their peers. So my suggestion is to take them at their word. Let the admissions committees cull out from the 40,000, let's say, those who could not flourish in the university and could not contribute. How many would be left? Well, I don't know, maybe 30,000 or 25,000 or 32,000, whatever the number. Among those who are qualified, do a lottery to determine admission. Now, this would not dismantle the credentialist prejudices that writ large breed resentment among those who are excluded in our societies. But we should be realistic about that. But it might begin to chip away at least a little at the meritocratic hubris of the winners, to remind them of the role of luck that figures in their admission, even under the existing system. In other words, to highlight what is undeniably the case, that one's ability to qualify for a top university or a top job or to make a great deal of money in the economy, this is not down only to the doing of the person, but we are indebted in a great many ways, indebted in ways that a single-minded focus on making it on our own obscures. And so the lottery proposal is one modest suggestion about how we might begin to shift attitudes in this way.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to iai.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
Modest in the tradition of Jonathan Swift, Michael.
Radical.
No, and of course it does raise all kinds of interesting questions about what happens to the alumni preference that's so embedded into universities, and perhaps that should be disclosed when people come out of those universities on that basis. I think that's obviously and potentially quite a radical social marker and a kind of signal of intent if any university was sufficiently strong to do that. What about the issue of how one engenders more of a sense of what you might call, I think you describe at one point as practical wisdom and civic virtue. And let me just give you a case for a second. So I always thought one of the great strengths about America was that, sure, a lot of lawyers came out of university, but actually there were an enormous number of engineers who came out of university. And many of those engineers came out, not because they'd mastered the theory of engineering, but because they were really good engineers. They had been taught to be good engineers. And there are plenty of colleges around America where that has been the case. And some of them have close ties to particular companies and come out of that corporate tradition. Now, of course, when you make everything a matter of your cognitive elite, and there are then overwhelming financial incentives for people to go into finance, consulting, and the law, all of these meta activities, you are, in a way, directing many of your most talented people away from forms of education where you'd say, actually, we're not interested in this cognitive outcome. We just want a really good engineer. And that can involve a very widespread set of skills, from team leadership and communications through to materials science and the rest of it. And I always thought it was a shame that America hasn't preserved that practical and civic conception of what a human being might be coming out of a university.
Yes. And so this suggests another set of policies, which I do suggest as a way of redressing this imbalance. And that is to invest far more than we do in forms of learning that may not be the most prestigious, but that are terribly important to prepare people for the world of work, the majority of people actually. And that includes state colleges, two-year community colleges, which disproportionately serve those who come from families who have not been to college or university, and also forms of vocational and technical training and apprenticeships. I think that we should massively invest in those areas because we currently don't support them to the degree that we should. Not only to strengthen them economically as avenues of learning for the world of work, but also a way of enlarging the honor and prestige we associate with those forms of learning, and by implication, the forms of work that flow from them. I think we should try to break down the hierarchy of prestige that says, in effect, if you don't go to a four-year university, preferably a brand name one, then you're someone who society will look down upon or not appreciate very fully. I think we should overcome this. And so this really is one way of doing it. I think there are other ways of reconfiguring the economy and even the tax code. For example, why should earnings from labor be taxed at a higher rate than earnings from interest and dividends? That should be a public debate, not only from the standpoint of who best can bear the burden of taxation familiar arguments about redistribution, but also from the standpoint of prompting a debate about the dignity of work and what counts as a valuable contribution to the common good. So the policy proposals I make in the book are not a policy blueprint that could in and of itself solve the problem. They're designed to prompt reflection, a different kind of public debate, focusing on questions not only of jobs and pay, but also questions of meaning, recognition, esteem, dignity, and respect.
Yes, one of the things that's so nice about the book is that although it is absolutely a work of analysis and philosophy and in itself a discursive contribution to lead an argument about the public good, it also doesn't shy away from some quite crunchy, not a lot of them, but some quite crunchy policy prescriptions that do precisely what you say. They energize debate. They get people moving and thinking. They might agree or they might disagree, but they don't have the option of staying still once they've read the book. And of course, it seems to me that all of this achieves that much extra urgency in the context of a COVID pandemic in which some of these very ill-reputed, low-esteemed jobs have turned out to be completely vital to our well-being, both individually and as a society.
Right. And this gives me hope that this moment, Jesse, of crisis and pandemic could be a moment of awakening. It could provide an opening for a discussion about who really does make a valuable contribution to the common good. And we're noticing, we can't help but notice, those of us who have the luxury of working from home and holding meetings on Zoom, how deeply we depend on the work of workers we often overlook. I'm thinking here not only of those who heroically are looking after COVID patients in hospitals, who are doing tremendously important work, but delivery workers, warehouse workers, grocery store clerks, home healthcare workers, lorry drivers. And these are not the best paid and most honored workers in our society. And yet now we're calling them key workers, essential workers. But if that's the case, then apart from clapping for them, what can we do? At least this could be an opening for a political debate. What can we do? How can we reconfigure the economy? The economy of pay, but also the economy of esteem, to bring their reward and recognition into better alignment with the importance of the work they do.
One of the many incidental pleasures of the book, for those of a more philosophical disposition, is the way in which it shows how quite a wide variety of positions on issues of justice and merit in political philosophy, in fact, take a viewpoint that tacitly reinforces some of the meritocracy that Michael is critiquing. And I'm not sure that's something we should discuss in any detail in a family program, ladies and gentlemen, but it's of great interest to those who want to get into some of the more thorny theoretical issues. And I personally greatly enjoyed that. Let me just ask one other question, though, Michael, which is, if one just thinks about the arc of your own work, significant focus on critique of prevailing ideas about justice, the just society, John Rawls, some of the work that you did then in formulating your own book on justice, now a book on tyranny of merit, your previous one on what you might call the limits of the marketplace and the commercialization and financialization of the public realm. Are we seeing, is there a kind of implicit architecture to this line of thinking, Michael, and should we be looking for a new theory of contributive justice from you in the years to come?
Well, thank you for that question, which does kind of prompt me or forces me really to articulate the common thread running through, which I would like to do in a minute. But the idea of contributive justice, the term you've just used, is one that figures in the new book on the tyranny of merit, where I suggest that we shouldn't focus only on distributive justice, that question arises almost too late, because the question of contributive justice prompts us to ask what counts as a valuable contribution to the common good, and how should we reward such contributions? We have outsourced our moral judgment in that regard to markets in recent decades. We assume that the money people make is the measure of their contribution to the common good, but this is a mistake. It's a mistake philosophically for reasons that I develop in the book, but it's also a mistake politically because it deprives democratic citizens of reasoning and debating and arguing together about the meaning of the common good. How else could we discuss what counts as a contribution worth encouraging, cultivating, nourishing, and rewarding, unless we could arrive at some conception as a society of the common good? Now, the thread that you generously invited me to trace back through my early writings, I think is this. There is a powerful picture of freedom that animates the version of liberalism that I criticized early on, that also figures in the embrace of markets that I addressed in What Money Can't Buy, the kind of market faith, I mean, beyond the practical benefits of markets, but the deep market faith, and that also figures in meritocracy, in the picture of the person, of freedom, is connected with a picture of the person along the following lines. It's the idea, and think about the discussion we've just had now about success, my success being my own doing. I've made it on my own, and therefore I deserve the benefits that flow from the exercise of my efforts and talents. What animates this idea is a certain conception of freedom, that if chances are truly equal, if I'm not held back by disadvantages of race or class or ethnicity or gender, then I can think of myself as self-making, as self-made, as a kind of master of my fate. That's the deep appeal of the meritocratic promise. My success is my own doing, the product of my own effort and talents. I've made myself, I've made my success, and that's why I deserve the benefits that flow from it. This is an appealing idea of human agency. And yet, it's flawed. And that's been the argument through the various books that you've brought to mind, Jesse. It's flawed because it assumes that to be a human agent, to exercise freedom, is something we can do as a matter of self-mastery and self-creation. And I argue instead, and have argued throughout in these various contexts, that we need instead to understand freedom as a kind of civic freedom that recognize our indebtedness and our embeddedness in the communities that make our success possible and that give meaning to our lives, and that, for that matter, holds societies together.
Michael, thank you so much. What an absolutely marvelous way to end. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed that. I have thought it was a wonderful moment, and I would encourage you all to load up on Michael's new book, The Tyranny of Merit, and enjoy its riches. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you, Michael Sandel.
Thank you, Jesse. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. Remember to like, subscribe, and review wherever you listen. And tune in next week for more big ideas from the world's leading thinkers.